Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre. Here in early August 2022, the global carbon dioxide level is 418.45 parts per million, and there are 2,708 days remaining until the year 2030. The clock keeps ticking. Well, the climate, I don't want to say battle, that's too much of a weighted phrase. The efforts to address climate change go on many, many different fronts. And in fact, part of the issue in addressing climate change is shifting more than just laws, but the way people think about themselves in the world. I mean, how do they fit into the universe? What's their worldview? The climate movement has recognized lots of opportunities over the past 15 or 20 years to take action creatively. I point you at, say, divestment that the 350MA, the 350 people started basically to deny oil companies social license, right? And they're doing the same thing now with banks and with law firms and PR firms, et cetera. On top of that, there's ongoing lawsuits. I mean, the Attorney General of Massachusetts is suing Exxon. There's cases against the big oil companies on the legal front across the spectrum. And one of the other things that's come forward in recent years is the recognition that environmental justice is inherently linked to the climate fight. It's essentially, to my mind, one and the same thing. So if you think big about what opportunities are out there to address climate change and shift the way we place ourselves in the universe, sort of the galaxy brain big thinking takes the environmental justice idea and says, every human being has a right to fresh air and clean water, right? And then the penny drops. You say, okay, that if that's a right, it could be constitutionally protected. And so this leads to an idea that there ought to be inscribed in the laws of our country somehow legal amendments to constitutions that say you have a right to a clean environment. Great idea, right? And it's a shifting of the way we think about stuff. Well, fortunately, we have with us today someone who quite literally wrote the book about green amendments and where the project, where the idea came from, where it's going, and we're pleased to talk to her. Today, we'll be talking with Maya Van Rossum, who is the founder of the Green Amendments, the Green Amendment for the Generations, a nonprofit that basically is supporting this project nationwide. But she's much more than that. She's also the Delaware Riverkeeper and has been active in an environmental, I'm not even sure what the right word, environmental justice, opposing fracking in Pennsylvania through legal and grassroots efforts. A wonderful person, knowledgeable. So thrilled to have her with us today to tell us about green amendments. So Maya, welcome. Maya Van Rossum, welcome aboard.
Thank you so much for having me, Ted. I'm really pleased about the enthusiasm with which you introduced this idea of constitutional green amendments. It means a lot to me because I think it is a transformational pathway that we all need to hop on.
So as I said, I told a story, but I'm not the expert. Please tell me, what should people who haven't really thought much about this, right, who are listening to this podcast, what should they know about a green amendment, why it matters, how they can help, all that kind of stuff? Tell me this story. And if I said something wrong in my introduction, here's your chance to correct me.
No, everything you said was just fine, just fine. So there are really two different ways, and seeing as you give me the opening, there are two different ways for people to be led onto the pathway of constitutional green amendments, right? One of the pathways I think about when I'm talking with environmental activists and advocates is the idea that, you know, when each one of us has gone to an environmental rally or event of one sort or another over the years, inevitably we have heard somebody say, and we have a right to clean water. We have a right to clean air. And I'm sort of the deflator in the room that says, well, no, not really. I mean, you have that right in your heart. You have that right in your mind as a human being here on this earth. That certainly is an inalienable right that you have. But here in the United States of America, because that right is not enforceable, it's really beautiful language. It's a beautiful vision and perspective, but it's not one that plays out in reality, because if you can't enforce it, then what good is it to have it? You don't actually have it. So that's sort of one pathway in. And then the other pathway in is I really highlight for people. I mean, think about it. Throughout the entirety of your lives, you've heard about all the fundamental rights you do have. You have a right to free speech. You have a right to freedom of religion. You have private property rights. You have civil rights. People have gun rights, right? That of all kinds. And yet we do not actually have a right to clean water, clean air, a stable climate, and healthy environment. So how is it possible that we have a right to free speech? How is it possible that we have a right to bear arms? And yet we don't have a right to these essential fundamentals of life, clean water, clean air, a stable climate, and healthy environment. So there's a huge disconnect here in the United States of America when you think about that reality.
When you put it that way, it's a real forehead slapper, right? You say, yes, of course, why is this not an obvious thing that should be present in everyone's constitution?
Yeah. Exactly. And you think about it when you were in elementary school, right? You learned about all those other fundamental rights. You never thought about environmental rights because nobody ever talked about it. In fact, you know, certainly when I started the Green Amendment movement a number of years ago, you know, it was very easy for me to say, you know, to really, when I was giving talks and things, to say, when was the last time somebody talked to you about your right to clean water and clean air? And I very would say, probably never, until this very second. Of course, now that the Green Amendment movement is really gaining traction and recognition, people are starting to hear about it. People are starting to think about it. So it's a little harder for me to say that, which I'm actually proud of, because it means
that
they read the book, they read an interview. But that really is what a constitutional Green Amendment does, right? Is it changes the entire landscape legally for how we recognize and protect our real rights to clean water, clean air, a stable climate, and healthy environment. And at the same time, accomplishes, Ted, what you so powerfully talked about. It changes the way we think about the environment, environmental protection, and environmental rights. Because now when people are talking about advocating for clean water and clean air, they are not just talking about, you know, something powerful and important that they believe in, but it is actually that something that they are now, with a Green Amendment, become constitutionally entitled to. And so that really changes and shifts the narrative, the conversation, and the way people think about things like clean water, clean air, and a stable climate. It's not just a hope, a wish, and a dream. It's a constitutional right that you can enforce in the courts when you have to.
That's a fascinating way to put it, because, I mean, your default is to assume that you have a right to free speech, right? And so anything comes along, I mean, you say, no, that's violating my right. Whereas now, for a Green Amendment, you don't have a right to clean water and fresh air. You're sort of fighting to get that happen, whereas if it was like in the Constitution that said, of course you have a right, then it's a much more powerful position to be taking. So tell me, don't let me distract you, but it's like, if there was a Green Amendment in a Constitution, and we'll get into whether state, federal, blah, 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 all that kind of stuff, it would basically it would be the reason for overturning laws. Right. Just the way a free speech, if someone says, you know, you don't have a right to religion, that law gets overturned as unconstitutional. Right. How do you see it playing out in terms of, I mean, the most obvious thing nowadays is kind of this whack-a-mole thing of stopping pipelines and infrastructure being. Would such a thing help there?
So it's a great question. And there's a yes and an in time. So I am going to actually first address the question of state versus federal. So here in the United States of America, the states have a tremendous amount of power when it comes to the environment and environmental protection. And so too does the federal government. They have a tremendous amount of power, and sometimes they can preempt state authority. And often they set the floor, they set the bottom, they set the bare minimum on what environmental protection should be. and then states can do more or better. And so when you look at this legal...
Just an example, I mean, California would be an example of that, right? California has more aggressive environmental laws, right, that they have imposed, and that's recognized by the feds.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. And so when we talk about constitutional green amendments, in order to get all the protections that they provide, we need them in both our state constitutions, which apply at the state level, and our federal constitution, which applies at the federal level. We will always need them both because of this split sort of authority when it comes to the environment and environmental protection. Strategically, my Green Amendments movement is about getting constitutional Green Amendments added to the Bill of Rights section, not just the Constitution. There's specific language and placement that is critical if we want to raise up environmental rights to that highest level. But the strategy is to get constitutional green amendments in state after state after state, right? Every state constitution across the nation. And while we're doing that work, we will eventually, in the coming years, reach a tipping point. And it will be clear that the people in the country are ready to start to advocate for a federal green amendment. And so when we hit that tipping point, we will add the federal green amendment effort to our state by state strategy. Now, you're right. Like, how does a green amendment change things? First off, it's not an instant panacea, right? It's going to take time to get the full power and benefits of a green amendment. And we can think about those other fundamental rights, like free speech. We've had them for hundreds of years, so we have a pretty good sense of what they mean, when and where. But we still have some litigation, right? Because there are still new contexts and uses and arguments that come up. So it's going to take time to build that really good understanding. And then we're going to have to build more and more over time, the power and the strength and the clarity of what it actually means to have a constitutional right to a clean, safe, and healthy environment. But amongst the kinds of things where right now we have three states that have green amendments, only three, Pennsylvania and Montana. And just last year, we secured one in the state of New York. Okay. And what we can see in Pennsylvania and Montana is we have used constitutional green amendments, as you said, to overturn bad laws, unconstitutional laws, to force the rescission or the voiding out of permits for industrial gold mining operations and other activities that would result in constitutional environmental rights infringements. We've been able to use the green amendments to secure government action where it was lacking. For example, advancing protections against PFAS water, drinking water contamination, and securing the cleanup of a highly toxic site known to be toxic for decades that the government had ignored. Municipalities have used the Green Amendment to protect their authority, their right, obligation, and authority to protect local natural resources, both one, supporting good decisions, but two, also preventing the state government from usurping their constitutional authority to make good decisions, notably in the zoning context, but as well as other contexts. So
when you say that, we're right now going through a big roundabout of zoning building codes in Massachusetts. And does the state or the locality have the right to do these, say, and natural gas hookups in new homes, things like that? It's quite a to-do. So you're speaking to a thing where this Green Amendment could be used to help the localities protect their right to be green, as green as they want to be.
Exactly. Exactly. And to render better decisions and in a variety of different ways. Again, from their authority being usurped by the state government saying you must do this very bad thing environmentally, whether or not you want to. And then the state municipality has been able to say in some contexts, whoa, we have a constitutional obligation to protect the natural resources of our communities. And you can't force us to engage in unconstitutional behavior. Right. That's one. And then two, we've also had municipality use the Green Amendment as a foundation to render really good decisions. Particularly, I'm thinking about the preservation of an old growth beech forest in a suburban community that's been quickly urbanizing. And it's a 200-year-old beech forest, quite unbelievably, in this suburb outside of Philadelphia. And they were able to, in very significant part, rely on the Green Amendment to say no to the development proposal of this forest. Mm-hmm. And one of the things, like we all know, when municipalities, when government officials try to say no to things like development projects, what is often the response from the developer? Takings. I have constitutional property rights. And if you say no to me, you are violating my constitutional property rights. And I characterize that as a taking. And you can only do that if you pay me lots of money. And often there that assertion is frankly actually not accurate in the context that it's being used, but the threat or the fear of the threat often forces local governments to knuckle under and say okay, even though they don't think it's the right decision, because they're so fearful of the legal challenge and what would be the ramifications. But now it's not just that the developer has property rights, but it's now that the people have environmental rights. And so you have a really powerful counterbalance.
So tell me, I have in front of me, in case you don't have, but my question is, what exactly, when you say a Green Amendment, what's the language? Are you advocating for the same language across every state? Or shall I read it? I mean, I've got
no, don't read it, because it's not specific language.
Okay, tell me, what is in a Green Amendment? What does it call for? What is the common thread between, say, Pennsylvania, Montana, and New York that make them a Green Amendment? What's the commonality?
Yeah. So the first thing to know is that almost every state, literally like 46, talks about the environment in their constitutions. But it is only these three states that have constitutional Green Amendments. So that's sort of a number one. So it really is, there are a green, in order to be a Green Amendment, you have to meet specific criteria. And that criteria is not just talking about the environment or environmental rights and sticking it in a constitution. So that's sort of number one. And number two, I just want to preface before I give you some of those criteria, is that by design, my Green Amendment movement is not about cookie cutter language. Different states have different challenges, different priorities, different personalities, and it's really important that their constitutional Green Amendment reflect those differences so that the people truly can embrace them and get behind it. And when they ultimately get their constitutional Green Amendment, it is protecting the environment and their environmental rights in the way the people of that state want. So by design, it is not cookie cutter. That's why whenever somebody says to me, well, is there some national organization that wants to take this on? I say, really, I hope not. If they'd like to partner up and work with me, that's fine. But this is a simple concept that's quite complex to get right. And it can't be cookie cutter, and it can't be about people getting money and grants. Certainly, I need money and grants to do the work and to work with communities. But that is not the part, right? This is not a fundraising tool. This is a save the world tool. So amongst the criteria is the language absolutely must be in the Bill of Rights section of the Constitution. That's where we recognize and protect those other rights, right? Those other human, civil, political rights. You want environmental rights to be protected in the same most powerful way? You got to place it in the Bill of Rights. The language has to be self-executing, which means it has legal life and enforceability in its own right. When it says the people have a right to clean water, if all the laws in the state are focused on how much pollution is allowed to go into the water and the water becomes so contaminated that there's a problem, the people can turn directly to their right to clean water and enforce it. It's not defined entirely by the legislation or the legislators of the state, right? The right to clean water stands on its own. State laws and regulations should be designed to help achieve that right. But when those laws and regulations fall short, the people can turn to the Constitution for the enforcement tool they need to say these laws are falling short. Here's how, here's why in this context.
So, and the analogy would be to free speech, which you have a right to, regardless of what any particular law, you have a right that is in there. And that is what you call self-executing. That's the thing that by itself is sufficient to guarantee you that right.
Correct. And connected with that is the idea that it applies to all government officials at every level of government. So one of the things that a lot of the states with existing language do and say is they may very well say that people have a right to clean water and clean air as defined by the legislators of that state in the laws they pass. Well, first off, it's no longer self-executing. It is now entirely defined by the laws that are passed. And so if those laws suck, and they allow environmental racism and people to be forced to drink, you know, be subjected to contaminated water and contaminated air, and they don't help, you know, avert a climate crisis. Well, you know what? You got the language, but you're no better off. So it robs the self-executing nature. But the other thing that that kind of language does is it gives all the power to the legislators. Right. And so they can do their politics and their politicking. And so then it's not that that local town council doesn't have that same power and authority. The judiciary, the right of the people is now that your legislators will legislate, even if they legislate badly. So when a case goes to court, the judiciary doesn't have the same obligation to protect environmental rights. They have an obligation to determine whether or not your legislators passed laws, good, bad, or otherwise, because that's all that you were promised, right? So it's an entirely different. So a Green Amendment has to be written in a way that it applies to the executive branch, the legislative branch, the judicial branch, the local town council, the state legislators, everything in between. Those are must-have elements. And the amendment has to be clear that we're talking about these essentials of life, clean water, clean air, a stable climate, the natural values of a clean and healthy environment. Not like some states that talk about you have a right to fish, hunt, and trap. Those may certainly be valued and valuable rights, but that is different than the right to clean water and clean air, right? So that's another piece. Those are must-haves. But then there are really essential, powerful elements, like the language should be generational, that the people, including future generations, have these rights. That really ups the ante on what government must to accomplish in terms of environmental protection. It has to be learned long-term. It brings in things like the climate. Even if your Green Amendment language doesn't specifically mention the climate, which I would suggest it should, but they don't all do that, you can still get to it through both the generational language and the fact that the climate crisis contaminates water, contaminates air, right, devastates environments. But that generational language brings in an additional powerful element of forcing government to think and protect long-term. I also suggest that the language include what we call trustee language, so that the state is the trustee of the natural resources for the benefit of all people, including future generations. For those who have heard about the concept of the public trust doctrine, which you hear about a lot in the environment, this is a little bit different than that. This is broader than that. This is stronger than that. This is about treating natural resources kind of in the same way you would treat a money trust. When somebody is the trustee over money for the benefit of beneficiaries, they have a lot of fiduciary obligations. They have an obligation to act with prudence, meaning they have to do their research. They have to do their work. They have to know what will be the ramifications of their actions before they take them with regards to that money. The same happens in the environment. As a government official, you have to understand the facts, the science, the cumulative impacts. If you ignore all that powerful information, then you are not acting upon your fiduciary obligation of prudence. You have to, as a trustee, treat all beneficiaries equitably. Everybody has the same rights. So you must protect them equitably across communities and across generations. That's incredibly powerful in the environmental context for environmental justice, because we all have the same, not only the same rights to a clean, safe, and healthy environment, but our government officials are the trustees of the natural resources for the benefit of all the beneficiaries who have to And therefore, they have to protect those natural resources equitably for all those people, regardless of race, ethnicity, you know, economics, generation. So it's very powerful from an environmental justice perspective when you include that trustee language. And then there are just other different kinds of things that I do talk about, you know, like we commented on climate. I think it's very, very important. Right now, there's a lot of litigation trying to get courts and to read a right to a stable climate into existing constitutional language where it's like not
privacy rights in the, at the federal level, kind of.
That's right. Well, as we can, you know, what I've been saying for years and as was really just hammered home by the Dobbs case before the Supreme Court, if your constitution is not explicit about what you are trying to protect, then number one, your courts don't have to read the rights into it. And number two, even if they do, they can be stripped away at any time. So the beauty of a Green Amendment is we're not trying to talk anybody into reading anything into anything when it comes to the climate. We're being very clear. We, the people, have a right to a stable climate. You, government officials, are constitutionally bound to protect our climate for the benefit of present and future generations, right? And ensure those resources, including the climate, are protected equitably across communities, regardless of race, ethnicity, wealth, right, generation. And so
that presumably, I guess, the those important points, which I agree all make complete sense, that can probably be summarized into a relative, like a paragraph. It's not 500 pages of litigation stuff. I mean, it's like these simple declarative statements that, like you just said, that would almost constitute the amendment, right? That you act as a trustee, you must act equitably. It looks to intergenerational justice.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, if people come and work with me, and what I ask people is, please get in touch with me, get in touch with my Green Amendments for the Generations organization and movement, and let me work with you as a partner to make sure you get it right. Because it is pretty simple. I do lay it out in my book, The Green Amendment, in writings I've done on the website forthegenerations.org. And yet it still can be quite complex. And it is very easy for people, even constitutional lawyers, I've found, can get talked out of doing it the right way, get talked out of understanding that the Bill of Rights placement, for example, is really important, or that self-executing is essential. And so if I can be your partner, you can still be the lead in your state. But if you bring me on as a partner, we can work together to make sure that when you get over that great big body of work to secure your constitutional environmental rights, that it is a true Green Amendment, because only a true Green Amendment raises up environmental rights to that highest constitutional level, along with those other fundamental rights.
So let's follow that thread. Say again, tell me again the nonprofit organization, and explicitly what the URL is so that people can go there. And then I got a couple of questions that follow on from that, but what's the URL? How do people find it?
Yeah. So it's Green Amendments for the Generations. The URL.
Word. Oh, go ahead. Yep.
The URL is forthegenerations.org, F-O-R, forthegenerations.org. The truth is, if you were to type in greenamendments.org, you would also get back to the same website. But I really wanted to emphasize the For the Generations nature of this when I first began the movement. But the terminology of Green Amendment really is what has caught on and captured people's imaginations. So, you know, you can go to either URL and end up in the same place.
And do you find that, so someone could go there, say someone from Massachusetts. So, I mean, not to put you on the spot, do you know if there's an effort here in Massachusetts underway to make such an amendment?
Yeah. So I make it my business to make sure I know everywhere where there's an effort happening, because hopefully everybody's brought me in as a partner. And if they haven't, I do try to reach out to say, hey, can we please partner up? Let me just help you. Let me be a resource. I'm not trying to steal your thunder. I just want to make sure that we get this right, because it is hard to get a constitutional amendment, and it's not worth it if you do it wrong. But I can tell you, I've been to Massachusetts a couple of times and given a couple of talks, and there has been interest from individuals and organizations, but nobody has risen up to say, I want to do this. And and my rule is I want to inspire. And once there's interest, I want to support, engage, and help make it happen. But I don't presume to suggest that I know what's right for your state. So I'm not going to come into Massachusetts, for example, and say, you should do this and you should do this now. It's up to the people of Massachusetts to say, we want this and we want this now. And when they make that decision, if they call me up and invite me in, then I will work really, really hard to help make it happen. But no, I've been there in Massachusetts a couple of times, but so far, I haven't had that invitation in.
But I think that, and this is like an open invitation to anyone who's listening, I don't think you would need to be a constitutional scholar to begin this process. You probably will enlist lawyers, because I was looking at the Massachusetts Constitution before we talked, and it's like a long document with lots of these airy references to the environment, but nothing specific, right? And so the engine for taking action could be someone who just cares a lot about it and brings in people like you, and then maybe people that specifically know about the Massachusetts Constitution, and you just follow along and figure out what to do. So if you're listening to this podcast and looking for a way to make yourself feel better, this is a good idea, right? To begin.
Yeah, give me a amendment. Call.
The
thing is, and the truth is, right? So this is what I will help people do, because, you know, I've been in states where somebody brought in a constitutional law professor who knew about the state. And the truth is that person was super smart about the Constitution and that state, but they weren't super smart about green amendments.
Right.
And so, you know, we need to make sure that we educate them. And when they, think they know it all, but they don't, we need to find really engaging ways to help them understand we all need to learn more, right? One of the, you know, the green amendments, we have green amendments in over a dozen states. And some of our most powerful green amendment efforts are not just places like New Jersey and Delaware or hopefully in Massachusetts, but New Mexico, Washington, Hawaii, Iowa has a green amendment proposal. There's a green amendment proposal. There's not a lot of activity behind it, but there's a legislator in Arizona that we worked with to develop green amendment language right for their state. So there's a lot of, Maine has a powerful green amendment movement. And when you look at, and I write about this in the second edition of the book, The Green Amendment, that's coming out November 1. And I make this point that you've made, Ted, anybody can be the engine to make this happen. Hopefully it's a solar powered engine. And like, my New Mexico movement, one of the most powerful green amendment movements, it started because somebody heard me on a show like this. They called me up and I answered. Same thing in Maine. A single person read the book, loved the idea, and said, how do we make it happen? In other states, it was an organization or somebody with an environmental organization. Usually they're pretty small organizations. They're not the biggies. Call me up and say, how can we make it happen? And the first thing I do with them is we talk and we plan to give some talks to other organizations and to the public to spread the word, and then to invite people to want to join a leadership team. And then from there, we start having monthly, bi-monthly, or weekly strategy meetings. And as you said, we come together and we talk and say, okay, what's the right language for this state? What do you think? Who's going to be the right legislative champion or champions? Who else do we need to make sure is at this table to be part of our, right? And we worked, what are the tools we need to develop? At Green Amendments for the Generations, we'll make a state-specific website. For Massachusetts, it would be www.magreenamendment.org. You want to see what New Mexico's is? Go to nmgreenamendment.org or Washington, wagreenamendment.org. Uh-huh. And so there'll be a ready-made place where people who are starting to hear about it can type in a URL, go in, see who's working on the issue, see what the resources are, see how they can get engaged. And, you know, and as you said, it develops organically together from there, but it all starts with this partnership, somebody from the state, myself and my Green Amendment organization working together and figuring out what is the right pathway and language for that state. Right. Nothing's cookie cutter.
Nothing. Wow. So I'll say it again. It's forthegenerations.org is the URL. You will be very clear. You have the second edition of your book, The Green Amendment, due out in November. People can look for it probably on all the right Amazon, all those kind of places, right? Have it. Yeah. So
you can pre-order. You can get the current book, but I suggest holding off and getting the new one, because I really have put in a lot of new information. And thinking about your podcast focus, right, being the climate, there's a lot more emphasis on the climate power of green amendments. And I have a chapter on climate. Mm-hmm. So people who are really, wanting to hone in on the climate values,
there's a path there.
There's a path there.
Wow. Well, I guess this has been a fascinating discussion, and I think is germ for much future thinking. I mean, I think because it really is. I do think it's a fascinating idea, and it's one of I keep saying it's one of these things that once you say it, it's so obvious. Oh my God, why haven't we done it? And then it takes on a life of once you begin to talk about it. What we'll do is we'll put up, I promise soon to put up links on the MCAN blog. Will be hot links to For the Generations, to where you can find the second edition of the book. Maybe I'll go find the Washington Green Amendment website so people can look at it. Okay. That is on the massclimateaction.org. You look across the banner for newsletter and more. You pull that down. It says blog and podcast. And four clicks later, you could listen to the, you can get those hot links. Okay. If you have ideas about future shows that we ought to be thinking about, please send us an email to podcast@massclimateaction.net. Let us know what we ought to be talking about. You're probably listening to the show on your smartphone using Stitcher or Podbean or one of the modern podcast distribution apps. Please ask all of your friends to listen to us on their modern podcast distribution app. We're everywhere. I want to thank our good friend D.R. Tucker for his continuing research support. We want to close where we always close, by saying that we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, that we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and that we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out. Because of that, we have to insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, a price on carbon that respects environmental justice communities. And maybe now I need to add, and pass a green amendment in every single state. But anyway, Maya, thank you so much for this fascinating conversation. Please keep up the good work.
Thank you, Ted. And thanks for having me and helping me to spread the word. And I look forward to seeing you in person in Massachusetts when we're advancing our green amendment together there.
That sounds great. Thanks forever for listening. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.